Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Bob Doty reporting. Russia mediated Syrian peace talks end without breakthrough. Members of the Syrian government and some opposition groups ended talks Friday in Russia with no signs of progress on how to end the four-year civil war. It was the second round of largely unfruitful Syrian peace negotiations hosted this year by Russia, a close ally of embattled Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. Following the talks, opposition leader Kadri Jamil, who leads Syria's Popular Front for Change and Liberation, spoke of the need for a new international peace conference. The White House says U.S. President Barack Obama and his Cuban counterpart, Raul Castro, are expected to see each other on Saturday in a historic encounter at the Summit of the Americas in Panama. Mr. Obama and his Cuban counterpart have spoken by telephone ahead of the summit. The White House official said they reviewed efforts to fully restore U.S.-Cuban diplomatic relations. President Obama arrived in the Panamanian capital Thursday night for the Summit of the Americas, which for the first time includes communist Cuba. The president has previously signaled that he would be willing to drop the state terrorism label attached to Cuba as part of the normalization in diplomatic relations.
Throughout this process, our emphasis has been on the facts. So we want to make sure that, given that this is a powerful tool to isolate those countries that genuinely do support terrorism, that when we make those designations, we've got strong evidence that, in fact, that's the case. And as circumstances change, then that list will change as well.
Three other countries are on the list, Syria, Iran, and Sudan. This is VOA News. A Pakistani court has freed the alleged mastermind of the 2008 attacks on Mumbai that killed 166 people. Zaki Ur Rehman Lakhvi, a senior commander of the Pakistan-based militant group, Laskar-e-Taiba, was released on bail Thursday, officials say. Lakhvi had been in prison since February of 2009 when he and six others were charged in connection with a 60-hour assault on India's commercial capital in 2008. Iran's supreme leader says the Saudi-led coalition attacks on Houthi rebels in Yemen amount to genocide. Ayatollah Ali Khamenei's comments came as 2 weeks of airstrikes by a Saudi-led coalition have failed to stop the Houthi advance across the country. Tehran, believed to back the Houthis, has said it is sending Iranian warships into the waters off Yemen. Washington, for its part, has increased its support for the Saudi coalition with weapons and intelligence sharing. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry says Washington is very concerned by Iran's actions.
We're not, looking for confrontation, obviously, but we're not going to step away from our alliances and our friendships and the need to stand with those who feel threatened as a consequence of the choices that Iran might be making.
Speaking on the PBS NewsHour, Kerry said the U.S. is closely monitoring Iranian support for the rebels. U.S. media reports say Hillary Clinton will be on Sunday formally announcing her intention to run for president in the 2016 election. The former Secretary of State will announce her campaign for the Democratic Party's presidential nomination with an online video posted on social media, sources familiar with her plans told media outlets on Friday. They said she will then make stops in key early voting states, including Iowa and New Hampshire. A suicide car bomber targeted a convoy of U.S. forces in eastern Afghanistan Friday. Officials say the four civilians were killed and 12 others wounded. The Taliban claimed responsibility for the bombing. Visiting U.S. Defense Secretary Ashton Carter, who arrived in South Korea Thursday, says the U.S. military is preparing to deploy new weapons in the region, including stealth bombers and different classes of naval vessels, but is not yet prepared to discuss deployment of an advanced missile system.
So we're investing in advanced capabilities to make sure that our top new investments are tailored to this dynamic security environment and can play a role in assuring security here.
After meeting with his South Korean counterpart, Carter told a news conference Friday the deployment of the new system was not on the agenda. I'm Bob Doty in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. Coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
The World Health Organization says the risk of West Africa's Ebola epidemic spreading to other countries has gone down considerably. The WHO says Ebola continues to pose a threat and it still considers this deadly disease to be a public health emergency of international concern.
That's Lisa Schlein reporting from WHO headquarters in Geneva. Details coming up. Also in the news, Nigerians go to the polls tomorrow to elect governors and new state assemblies. And the Nairobi newspaper, The Standard, reports that more than four men were involved in the attack on Garissa University College last week. We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Rwanda, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on African News Tonight. Our top story this hour, Nigerians go to the polls tomorrow to elect governors and new state assemblies. The People's Democratic Party of President Goodluck Jonathan controls 21 of 36 states. The main opposition party, led by President-elect Muhammadu Buhari, controls 14. 29 states will be electing new governors, while all will vote for members of the state assemblies. General Buhari won the March 28th presidential polls with 54% of the vote. Observers are watching to see if his party will also gain in state elections. The voting comes as Nigerian troops continue to liberate areas held by the Islamic radical group Boko Haram. In the meantime, a security expert, Dr. Ona Ekumo, is urging the state and federal government to reinforce security at all institutions. His call, which was quoted in the Lagos-based Sun newspaper, comes as the first anniversary approaches of one of Boko Haram's most notorious attacks, the kidnapping of over 200 girls from Chinook in Borno State. Many observers think the girls were taken as wives or sold as slaves. Dr. Ekomo urged security experts to conduct security and threat assessments of schools in order to improve security. New measures could include smoke bombs to conceal students from attackers and electrified hardware to lock down schools in the event of an attack. Meanwhile, Cameroon says Boko Haram has resorted to kidnapping people in hard-to-access areas near the border with Nigeria. The Central African state has, however, rejected calls by Parliament to declare a state of emergency in the affected areas. Moki Edwin Kenzeka reports from Yaoundé.
Cameroon Defense Minister Edgar Aleme Bengo told Parliament that the Nigerian terror group Boko Haram is still actively committing atrocities, even though they have not been able to organize a major attack on Cameroon's territory for more than 2 months.
Au cours de cette descente sur le terrain, j'ai échangé également.
He says because of persistent small-scale attacks, hostage takings, kidnappings and killings, he has visited villages in northern Cameroon to assure local officials and traditional leaders that Boko Haram's inability to organize large-scale raids is an indication they are now weak and the incursions are just like the last lashes of a dying horse. Mbenga says although the attacks have been persistent, Cameroon's President Paul Biya has not found it necessary to declare a state of emergency in the remote areas where Boko Haram has been operating.
Le président de la République n'a pas cru devoir décréter.
He says the president of Cameroon has not seen the need to declare a state of emergency in northern Cameroon, but has decided to manage troop levels so that not even a millimeter of Cameroon territory should be occupied by the enemy. Joseph Mbandam, Vice President of Cameroon's National Assembly, says there has been a huge proliferation of arms in the area. He says Cameroon officials should investigate the origin of the arms.
We are all conversant with the fact that when a gun is shot, the case that contains the bullet falls
And I've seen many of our security people pick those shells. And from those shells, they can determine in whose hands those bullets were given. Why would you not supply us with concrete security information?
This week, Cameron said in spite of the decrease in deadly attacks, suspected Boko Haram fighters have been seizing food and livestock from farmers and cattle ranchers on its northern border with Nigeria, and most of the food producers were relocating to safer areas away from the border. The last major attack by Boko Haram on Cameroonian territory was on January 10 at Fotokol. 300 assailants attacked a military base, and a confrontation with soldiers killed 500 people. Moki Edwin Kinzeka, VOA News, Yaoundé.
The World Health Organization says the risk of West Africa's Ebola epidemic spreading to other countries has gone down considerably. But the WHO says Ebola continues to pose a threat, so it still considers this deadly disease to be a public health emergency of international concern. Lisa Schlein reports from WHO headquarters in Geneva.
The World Health Organization reports real progress is being made in Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea toward ending the 15-month Ebola epidemic. Nevertheless, WHO's Emergency Committee of Experts that just met to assess the current situation agrees it is premature for the international community to let down its guard. WHO Assistant Director General Bruce Aylward says the committee is quite firm in its belief that the Ebola outbreak continues to be an international health emergency.
The virus is still moving. There is still cases that are coming not off contact lists, still having deaths in the communities, etc. And the committee highlighted again and again that this began with one case, and in this current environment, until we're at zero, this may well continue to constitute a public health emergency of international concern. They did note, however, that they believe that the risk of international spread appeared to be reducing.
Dr. Aylward says the success is the result of work being done in several specific areas. He says contact tracing is essential to keep tabs on people who might be at risk of getting Ebola. This also allows communities to keep the movement of the disease under control. The senior WHO official says two other measures, exit screening by Ebola-affected countries and preparedness by these countries to rapidly address any new transmission, are important to prevent new cases of Ebola from emerging. Dr. Aylward says the emergency committee recommended that some temporary travel restrictions should remain in place, and it reiterated the importance of maintaining exit screening for at least 42 days after the last Ebola patient has tested negative.
And then probably the strongest recommendation was for all other countries that they avoid any unnecessary interference with international travel and trade and transport, and implement only the measures that are commensurate with the current public health risk and the current temporary recommendations.
The committee also opposed what it calls inappropriate health measures being implemented by some countries. These include quarantining or refusing entry in some cases of travelers returning from Ebola-affected countries. WHO reports there were only 30 confirmed cases of Ebola in the three West African countries last week. This is down from 150 cases 3 weeks ago and is the lowest number in nearly a year. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Fourteen past the hour, you were listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. The Nairobi newspaper, The Standard, reports that more than four men were involved in the attack on Garissa University College last week, and two may have acted as students living in rooms on campus. The paper cites a recent meeting of the Moi University Senate where the attack was discussed. It says sources close to one of the publications owned by The Standard, called The Nairobian, said two so-called students had extremist flags. One of them was allegedly found alive among those killed. The paper says a disaster response specialist at the meeting, Dr. John Simiyu, said at least one of the two claimed to be a student, but could not recall when asked the name of the vice chancellor of the school. He said the second one was taking photos with a cell phone and appeared to be in contact with someone at a remote site. Dr. Simiyu said the students' rooms were operating like command centers with mattresses and beds. Others say the room had food and supplies. Dr. Simiyu told the Nairobian paper that it looked like the attackers were in for a long battle that could have lasted for days. He said surviving students would receive psychological counseling once they return to the school. Many of them suffer from trauma. Meanwhile, counselors were called to help families of the 148 people killed in the attack on Garissa. At one morgue in Nairobi, the Associated Press wire service says families traveled for hours from rural areas to identify the bodies. Many had invested family savings to educate their children. Counselors said they talked one mother out of committing suicide. One counselor said she'd talked to about 50 relatives over the past week. She said all one can do initially is allow the grieving families to weep and encourage them to understand that they are cared for. One woman responded that the best thing to do is understand and accept what happened. She said crying helped her accept the reality and quickens healing. Margaret Kenyatta, the wife of President Uhuru Kenyatta, visited the Chiroma morgue this week, signing the mortuary book with the words, "Deepest condolences, Kenyans' unity in this trying times is truly heartening." 15 aid agencies have released a joint statement expressing concern over Kenya suspending the licenses of money remittance providers. Kenya took the action against 13 MRPs on April 7th in response to the Al-Shabaab terrorist attack on Garissa University. Kenya's decision follows similar action taken in recent months by the United States, Britain, and Australia to try to limit funds going to the Somali terrorist group. Ed Pomfret is the Somalia Campaigns and Policy Manager for Oxfam, one of the agencies that issued the statement. From Johannesburg, he spoke to VOA's Jody Kapawa about the Garissa attack and its effects on remittances.
Well, first of all, I think all of us at Oxfam would want to send our condolences to the victims of the attack in Garissa and the families of the victims. Clearly, Kenya does have a severe terrorist threat that it needs to deal with. However, the way to deal with that terrorist threat, in our view, is not to close down Somali remittance companies in a blanket fashion. We're really concerned about this because the flow of money from abroad into Somalia makes up at least $1.3 billion per year. That's actually more than development aid, humanitarian aid, and foreign direct investment combined. And we do know that at least 40% of Somalis rely on remittances from abroad for the basics of life, the basics of survival, food, water, shelter, education, medicine. What we're really worried about here is that if this flow of money is stopped, many more of those people will fall back into severe humanitarian crisis.
Does Kenya's decision affect aid agencies like Oxfam?
The method that we use in order to deliver aid into Somalia, and that can be paying contractors, paying salaries, office rent, and also transportation costs and what have you, a lot of that is done through Somali money transfer companies because in Somalia right now, there is no banking system, so there's no alternative.
Now, will there be a difference in how Somalis in Somalia are affected and those who are in Kenya?
It's hard to say exactly because the information is not very clear, but you can assume that also there are a lot of people in Kenya who use those remittance companies to receive remittances from abroad. From a Somalia perspective, that's the only method to receive remittances from abroad. I think you will find slightly differing impacts, but you can say for sure that there will be an impact on everybody concerned. Anybody who receives money through these remittance companies will be badly affected by the decision.
Has there been any response from the Kenyan government as to how long these suspensions might last? Is there an investigation underway to try to see whether these agencies are operating legally?
Not so far, and that is what we're asking for. What we really want to see, rather than closing remittance companies in a blanket fashion, what we think should happen is each individual company should be looked into in depth on an individual basis, and then the Kenyan government can ascertain fully whether they are complying with Kenyan regulations or not. None of us want to see terrorist attacks happen or money going to criminals, but what we do want to guard against is we need to make sure that the flow of remittances into Somalia for legitimate purposes is maintained. And so taking a blanket approach is not the right way forward. We've seen a similar sort of mistaken approach elsewhere in the world, in the UK, in the US, and also in Australia, which has caused huge problems. And in order to deal with the closures in some of these countries, Somalis abroad have often then found a way of transferring money through Kenya into Somalia. Now with the Kenya door closing as well, this is setting us up for a really severe increase in humanitarian crisis.
Does Oxfam and the other agencies that have issued this statement of concern have any recommendations as to how money might be transferred in a different way or what might be done to make the MRPs more viable?
I mean, as Oxfam, we're currently looking into our options. What I can say is that we don't have the option of wiring money in via a bank, because there are no banks operational inside Somalia. So essentially, by closing the remittance companies, we don't see too many alternatives at the minute. In the past, what we've seen people have to resort to is stuff cash into suitcases and fly it or drive it into Somalia. Now, again, that doesn't make sense. What we really want to see is we want to see money transfers regulated in a clear, open, transparent way, because that's the way that you can ascertain whether money is going to those who it's intended for or to criminals.
Ed Pomfret is the Somali Campaigns and Policy Manager for Oxfam. From Johannesburg, he spoke to VOA's Jody Kapua. Kenya's government has issued a report that shows spousal battery is the most common form of gender-based violence in the country. For VOA, Mohammed Yusuf reports.
In a report released Friday, the National Crime Research Center says 38% of females and 20% of males in Kenya have experienced gender-based violence. Mombasa County in the coastal region has the highest rate of assaults among married couples, with a rate of 97%. Meru County in the eastern region recorded the lowest rate. Stephen Muteti of the Kenya National Crime Research Center says women were more vulnerable to violence depending on their marital status.
If you are divorced or separated, especially for the female, chances were high that you would fall a victim. So the most vulnerable groups were the divorced and separated and the widowed.
According to the Crime Research Center, men use their physical strength to commit acts of violence while women use threats. Muteti knows there is a need to know the causes of gender-based violence in order to fight it.
The causes of gender-based violence, it is important to know as we intervene, what do we intervene on? So in doing this, we try to establish the relationship between the demographic variables and gender-based violence. And from the study, we realize that if you are an additional wife, chances of being violated are very high than the first wife.
In late March, women leaders in the country demanded a thorough investigation and prosecution of those who carried out violence against women. The women alleged sexual harassment was widespread in Kenya's parliament. Their call came as a woman alleged she had been raped by a male member of parliament. The woman accused him of assaulting and raping her in his private office in Nairobi, where she said she had gone on business. The legislator has denied the claims. The center's report says in the last year, more men have experienced sexual violence than women. Mohammed Yusuf of VOA News, Nairobi.
And a report by Uganda's Commissioner of Prisons reveals that serious overcrowding and understaffing in jails have created a health threat. A backlogged judicial system along with poor funding are posing a serious threat to prisoners, staff and the community. Elizabeth Paulette has more from Kampala.
In Uganda, incarceration rates have skyrocketed. The current prison system was meant to hold around 16,000 prisoners. However, a recent study shows that nearly 42,000 prisoners are serving time. Human Rights Watch says over half those inmates are still awaiting trial. There are only 5 doctors in the entire prison system. This has created a number of health crises, including the rise of multidrug-resistant tuberculosis. MDR-TB is an especially brutal strain that occurs when treatment of TB remains incomplete. The mortality rate can reach as high as 80%. Dr. James Kasambu, the head of prison health services, says that over 50% of the cases of MDR-TB in Uganda come from the prison system.
Now, the problem is when they go to the MDR centers, the guarding or protection or security around the MDR center is low. It is low for one reason, that when the prison guards come to learn that actually these people in there suffer from MDR, which may not cure, they keep a distance. So the security is lax. So when this guy recovers a little bit, able to run away, he runs away into the community, unhealed, maybe with multi-drug resistant TB this time, spreading to everyone else.
Kasambu is calling for the creation of an MDR-TB treatment center inside the prison at Murchison Bay to make sure patients complete the treatment. The prison has proposed renovating an old isolation ward for those with MDR-TB. However, funding remains a challenge. Kasambu stresses that the lack of proper health facilities puts all Ugandans at risk, as prison guards often fall victim to the same illnesses plaguing the inmates and pass them along to their own communities. The Commissioner of Prison report cites a slow-moving judiciary as one of the major causes of prison overflow. Inmates can stay locked away for years, just waiting for their case to be heard. Part of this is due to a huge backlog of cases. Vincent Emmy Mugabo, the president of the Ugandan Judicial Officers Association, says it is impossible for the current amount of judges to oversee all cases. But, he says, efforts are underway to increase the number.
We have requested Parliament to increase the number of judges. Indications are that they are accepting it. They are working on the financial implications. But at least we have indications that they have realized that if we need to take this service to all the people, then the creation of more courts and also appointment of more judicial officers. We have made 2 proposals. One is creation of more courts, but at least we know that we have the goodwill of Parliament and the Cabinet to increase the number of courts and officers.
Progress is slow, and a number of organizations, such as the U.S. Centers for Disease Control, have helped in the past to improve healthcare within the system. But for those stuck inside these prisons, life hangs in the balance. Elizabeth Pola, VOA News, Kampala, Uganda.
This is Africa News Tonight. I'm Yeheyis Wuhib in Washington. It's 29 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Everyone is looking for something special when maybe they should just listen instead. The VOA's African Music Mix will soothe your nerves and calm your head. Tune in from 0 to 300 UTC and 1100 to 1300 hours UTC to make you feel good. So treat yourself to that something special.
This is Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America, and here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. The Nairobi newspaper, The Standard, reports that more than four men were involved in the attack on Garissa University College last week, and two may have acted as students living in rooms and campuses. And the World Health Organization says the risk of West Africa's Ebola epidemic spreading to other countries has gone down considerably. Coming up, music from Rwanda. And in our feature segment, we look into the politics of famine and why food security is such a sensitive issue. I'm Hayes Wuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. Time now for the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young. Hello, Sunny.
Hello, Yeheyes.
Sunny, I understand you're beginning with African athletics.
Yeheyes, our starting line on the sunny side of sports is African athletics. April is a big month for international marathons, and African athletes, primarily those from neighboring Kenya and Ethiopia, will almost certainly be taking home prize money and winners' laurels. The two biggest marathons on the calendar this month are the Boston Marathon, April 20th, and the London Marathon, April 26th. Before Boston and London, though, there are some top European marathons this weekend, and I think we'll definitely see some African winners. In France, former champions Vincent Kipruto of Kenya and Atsede Baissa of Ethiopia have returned for Sunday's Paris Marathon. Kipruto won in Paris in 2009 in a personal best of 2 hours, 5 minutes, and 47 seconds. For her part, Atsede Baissa is a 2-time Paris Marathon women's champion, winning back-to-back titles in 2009 and 2010. In the Netherlands, Kenyan runners James Kwambai, Bernard Koech, and Jonathan Mayo are rated among the top contenders for the men's title in Sunday's Rotterdam Marathon. All three Kenyans have run under 2 hours and 5 minutes for the marathon distance. Kwambai was runner-up in Rotterdam in 2009, while Koech was the runner-up in the Dutch city last year. On the south coast of England Sunday, one of the newer international marathons will take place, the Brighton Marathon. This will be the 6th running of the English event. Kenyans have set course records in Brighton the past 4 years, and they'll be looking to set another one on Sunday. Kenya's Dominic Kangor, the 2013 champion, is back in Brighton. Fellow Kenyan Mutai Kipkimai is also expected to be among the leaders, while Ethiopia's Musa Babo Ido will try to stop the sequence of 4 consecutive Kenyan wins in Brighton. Some sad news on the sunny side of sports out of Morocco. A head-on collision between a bus and a truck has killed at least 31 people, many of them young athletes. 9 people were injured in the fiery crash early Friday morning near Morocco's southern desert city of Tantan. Local media report many of those on board the bus were school students participating in a national sports competition. Another report said the truck was a petrol tanker and the collision was followed by a terrible explosion. According to the U.S. State Department website, road accidents are a significant hazard in Morocco. Although there are modern highways between the main cities, the rest of the country is served by 2-lane roads, often in poor condition. Just ahead on the sunny side of sports, my VOA colleagues Tef Tef and Downtown Brown will have our English Premier League football question of the week.
The Voice of America.
Hey, this
This is VOA's Downtown Brown.
And I'm Tef Tef.
The EPL question of the week is, Charlie Adams' sensational 60-yard strike for Stoke City in a 2-1 loss against Chelsea Saturday has been described fantastic, unbelievable, and a once-in-a-lifetime goal.
Is it the best goal you've seen this season?
So let's first start off with saying Arsenal is in second place right now, and any goal that Arsenal has is an amazing goal. It's a top goal.
My God, so
every single thing that they do is amazing.
Only that.
All Arsenal fans, stand up. Give yourself a salute. A sunny side of sports salute.
You're just hijacking this question right now. How about we focus on all these fans that have said that this is probably the best goal they've seen this season? Give it up to, Stoke. They don't score much, but when they do, it seems that they actually, you know, score some beauties.
Yeah.
Yeah, with Peter Crouch's with the headers. But Charlie Adam just, man, watching that was the best. Unfortunately, their goalie gave up the game very last minute. You know, if Chelsea had tied, we would have had a title, race in our hands.
Oh, yeah.
But, you know, he gave it away after playing so well all game. So, yeah, what did fans say to this week?
So, Tef, you got your first shout-out by Umar.
Yes, keep him coming.
He said, wow, what a goal from Charlie Adams. This is the goal of the season. But for me, it's not the best I've ever seen. It should be Puskas Award. And note about that. And he gave us a shout-out to Tef Tef, Downtown Brown, and all staff of Sunnyside Sports. Thank you.
And we say hi back. Hi, Umar. Most of the comments actually said that it is one of the best goals they've seen, even Chelsea fans. Joshua said that it's one of the best goals he's seen scoring against my club. He said it was a thrilling goal. So Atime Marcus said, there are goals and then there are goals. This is the goal that shadows many goals. It's the best of the best for me in the APL so far. Obviously, a lot of people seem to think that it's one of the best goals, but so all of them seem to think that this is one of the best goals except one person.
Tiz Funky said, what's the biggie about this goal?
Should every long-range goal be termed once-in-a-lifetime goal?
I'm not surprised. The English can hype whatsoever.
I mean, I'm half in agreement. I remember Ibrahimovic scoring that goal against England when Sweden played in a friendly.
Yeah.
That bicycle kick goal. And, you know, everybody finally opened their eyes to Ibrahimovic. Like, he didn't exist a long time ago. But this is happening against England.
But at the same time, this is
actually a really good goal. Like, I mean, especially against one of the toughest defenses in England. And probably the second best keeper after De Gea in the league right now. David Courtois, who's already,
of course, it's De Gea we got to talk about.
I mean, speaking of best goal, it's been an amazing season for goalies this year.
So
and
where was De Gea when he played against Arsenal?
Ooh.
That was not his mistake.
Ooh.
Valencia, he's apologized already. But, yeah, man, so that was a great goal. But so did you have a favorite goal this season, or was that it for you?
My favorite goal of the season, like I said in the beginning, all Arsenal goals are my favorite. We can start with Alex Sanchez. We can start with Alex Sanchez when he, like, ripped one, the corner of the box, and just
drove past the play. Yeah, he did the step overs and stuff. Yeah, I mean, for me, the only thing I'll hold against Charlie Adams' goal is the fact that it was not a big game. It was a big game for Stoke, but it was not a big game. So I look back at big games, I have to give it to Coutinho, who scored two crazy goals against some big teams. So I think the level of the game defines how good a goal is. So for me, this season is in between Coutinho's goals against City and Mata's goal against Liverpool.
So moving on, let's talk about the table. I know I want to talk about the table because...
Oh, I want to talk about the table too.
Because Arsenal's right there. We're right in second place right now.
So are the Devils.
So, Tef, how do you feel about the tables changing?
I like it. I've always said from the beginning of the season that I would want to see the four traditional... Well, of course, Chelsea's not a traditional powerhouse, but since 2000, they've been there. So I want to see Chelsea, Arsenal, United, and actually Liverpool as the top four, which if United actually ends up beating City this weekend is a very, very good possibility. The other teams have been informed. City has been just really bad in the past few games. I think they've lost 4 out of 6 of the past games. So it's kind of, I feel bad for City, but I really don't. So I hope they don't make the top four. And if you're a City fan, I apologize, but you had it coming.
Yeah, because if they get kicked out the top four, you can say goodbye to almost every single player City has.
Oh, I mean, and the thing is, these are close to 30-year-old players.
Yeah.
I don't know how much money they can recover from them. You know, maybe Nasri will sell, but outside of Aguero, Yaya Toure is kind of old. Silva's nearing the 30s.
He might actually go to Series A.
Oh, yeah, actually, Inter Milan right now, they're very desperate to get him.
But
the one thing you can be sure about with the, fair place, City will not be able to spend enough money to come back with a young team, or at least a young best team.
And,
so,
and the funny thing is, this past January versus January transfers, a lot of teams stayed or re-signed their contracts. So a lot of big-name players are staying with their teams. So
exactly.
It's
going
to be even worse for
the market is small
next
enough.
Year.
Yep.
So,
yep. And again, Champions League football, every team wants, every player wants it. So even Liverpool and is going to have a hard time if they don't get Champions League spot. Yep. Same with City. Well, we'll just have to see. And I think this Sunday is a huge game for, I think, both sides. It can say United have arrived, the City becomes red again, or it says City still have hope and they're still in the game.
I'm VOA's Downtown Brown.
And this is Tough Tough.
Hey, have a great weekend, you guys.
You guys have a great weekend, too. My VOA colleagues, Tef Tef and Downtown Brown, with their English Premier League Football Question of the Week segment. Joining us now with more sports news is our Daybreak Africa sportsman, Mark Ouma.
We begin with football. Gambia are Africa's most improved team, while Liberia has slipped by the widest margin, according to the FIFA rankings released in Zurich, Switzerland on Thursday. Algeria's Desert Fox are 21st and are Africa's highest-ranked side. African champions Ivory Coast are 23rd, Ghana 26th, Tunisia 30th, Senegal 36th, and Cape Verde Islands 37th. Guinea is 41st, Nigeria 45th, Cameroon 48th, and the Republic of Congo 49th. Meanwhile, Egypt plays Burundi as Cameroon faces Zimbabwe. In weekend men's 2015 All-Africa Games qualifiers, Zambia host Nigeria, Ivory Coast engage Burkina Faso, as South Africa host Sudan, Ghana engage Mozambique, and Senegal host Mali. Elsewhere, defending champions Cameroon host Ethiopia, as Tanzania plays Zambia in women's All-Africa Games qualifiers, Ivory Coast face Guinea-Bissau, Zimbabwe engage Ghana, South Africa encounter Botswana, Nigeria tackle Mali, while Senegal host Egypt. In rugby, South Africa's Orchard Primary School in Orange Farm near Johannesburg make their debut at a one-day international under-12 rugby tournament in Monaco tomorrow, Saturday. The youngsters, who are predominantly from underprivileged backgrounds in Alexandra Township, north of Johannesburg, got a once-in-a-lifetime pep talk from President Jacob Zuma.
Sport is an important thing in the life of a person, a community, in the life of a country, in the life of the world. Sport widens your horizon of knowledge, creates social interaction, friends with the world. We call people like ourselves the ambassadors of our nation. You are a South African team, not just Orchard School. That's why we're here. That's why the minister is here. That's why I'm here. To encourage you to do your best. And you have jobs. If you win the tournament, come back with the cup. Minister and myself will come to Orchard's primary school to celebrate with you. Agreed? Did I promise? Come back with me then.
That was Jacob Zuma, South Africa's head of state. I'm Mark Ouma in Bloemfontein, South Africa, wishing you all a sporty weekend.
Thanks, Mark, and you have a sporty weekend, too. I'm VOA's Sonny Young, wishing all our Voice of America listeners a great weekend. And that's the Sunny Side of Sports. Back to Yehaeus Wuhi.
Thank you, Sonny, and listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 16:31 UTC and 18:31 UTC. And on Friday, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 17:30 UTC, right here on The Voice of America. Coming up, we look into the politics of famine and why food security is such a sensitive issue. And next, a young South Sudanese woman in Canada is about to publish her first book of poetry. But first, some music. Here is Kamachi from Rwanda with Bakasi.
Breach records. Washinja kuguca inyuma bazane babisubiremo attention petits ici affaires adolescents kamishi ni afrobeat piano muramuz
Garayo,
bazamwenyura
ejo bundi banyeretse amafoto nigenzure nsanga bakubeshyeraga mami
bazagusebya ngo badutanye nge sinzabumva muzi neza namaze kumenya icyakubabaje nta shingiro bifite
Machi from Rwanda with Bakase. Aid agencies began warning last year that without intervention, populations in South Sudan were at risk of falling into famine as a result of the ongoing civil conflict. But the government has denied the risk, Israel, and accuses humanitarian groups of using the warnings as a ploy to raise money. VOA's Gabe Joslow looks into the politics of famine and why food security is such a sensitive issue.
In July, a group of humanitarian agencies under Britain's Disaster Emergency Committee issued a warning that areas of South Sudan could fall into famine without immediate intervention. Similar warnings followed from other aid groups that millions of people were at risk. A famine, fortunately, was never declared, but the warnings rankled some South Sudanese officials, like Information Minister Michael Makwey, who told VOA he believes the agencies overhyped the threat to serve their own interests.
The figure which was projected by then was exaggerated. This is one. Number two, it was also meant to be another way of raising funds.
Part of the concern, McQuay said, is the government is not being given enough information about how humanitarian funding is being spent. He added, there is no real food insecurity in South Sudan, except among the displaced populations living in UN camps.
There is now a talk of over 1.5 million people who are in the threat of hunger. To me, I really doubt if there will be, if there is anything, because the harvest this year was good. Rains were very good and people cultivated.
To understand how food assessments are made, we have to look at the IPC, Integrated Food Security Phase Classification, an interagency initiative which ranks food security on a scale of 1 to 5, with 1 representing good conditions and 5 being famine. The most recent IPC puts 2.5 million people at crisis classifications 3 and 4 between January and March of this year. It notes that rains and harvests were decent, as Information Minister Makwey pointed out, but it says other factors, like rising market prices, depleted food stocks, and ongoing conflict, put added stress on populations. These factors, while not as obvious as malnutrition, can have a big impact on food insecurity. Speaking to VOA in the opposition-held town of Lankyan in Jonglei State early March, Acting County Commissioner Peter Thier said the influx of internally displaced people fleeing the war has added the greatest pressure.
From our side, we have shortage of food because of the IDF. Many people, they are running away from the government, joining the opposition side, in which we don't have the access for the road to Juba or somewhere else. So I can say we have problem of food.
One thing the IPC report does not mention is famine. The word is not used even once, despite the repeated warnings from aid agencies. But that does not mean the threat is not there. Sean Hughes with the UN World Food Program in South Sudan explains why.
Famine is a rather emotive word. For us in food security, it has a very technical basis. So in order for a famine to be declared, certain thresholds in terms of mortality and malnutrition must be surpassed.
For an area to be classified as being in famine, at least 30% of the population faces acute malnutrition, and the mortality rate must exceed 2 out of 10,000 people per day. Generally, it also denotes failure to act by government and other officials to prevent food insecurity from spiraling. Aware of the political sensitivities around the word, Hughes said food assessments are based on cold, hard facts to gain broad agreement and, when possible, government buy-in.
So we do try as much as possible to achieve that consensus. We ensure that it's absolutely based on evidence. And at times we do need to reserve the right and the mandate to tell it like it is, even if that news is not always favorable.
The next IPC report could come out in April. Agencies working on the ground worry that the coming rainy season could make the situation worse by reducing access to goods and impeding the humanitarian response. Gabe Joslow, VOA News, Nairobi.
A young South Sudanese woman in Canada is about to publish her first book of poetry. The poems in Niaboya Gatabel's book, The Fire Within, has a uniquely South Sudanese focus on what it's like to grow up as a refugee in a camp in Ethiopia and then in Canada. VOA fellow Lucy Pony talked to her.
You went kept dropping the soccer maze. It's incredible how people seem to be amazed. How is it that food fell from the heavenly sky? I wonder how did we get here? I mean, how did we get here? You see men and women running to grab a soccer maze. You see older adults fighting over food they can grow. The farmland left unkept because the UN provides food now. Wow, the farm is totally abandoned because it's too much work.
That is 21-year-old Gatbel reading her poem, The Sack of Maize. That poem and many others are included in The Fire Within, Gatbel's first collection of poetry, which will be published in May and released in June in English and Gatbel's native Nuer language. Gatbel says she's been writing poems since she was a child, growing up in Ethiopia and in Canada. She says writing helped her to express her feelings and try to figure out who she was.
And I felt like as a person, I had so many ideas or ideologies that I've developed throughout the years of being in both places. And I felt like I wasn't really represented neither by each culture because I felt like I wasn't Canadian and I wasn't technically African enough. So I kind of felt like in terms of how I thought about things, my view, it fell somewhere in the middle. And so what I did is as a kid to kind of express myself, I would write poetry.
Gatbel writes mainly of her experiences but also touches on societal issues of race, feminism, poverty, war and education. She says seeing South Sudanese men mistreat women in Ethiopia and even in Canada, knowing that South Sudanese women have been and still are deprived of education and the impact of an almost continuous war on the people of South Sudan was some of the spurs that drove her to write her brutally honest poems. Gatbel says she is wary of what kind of reception her poetry will be given, especially in South Sudan.
I'm not going to lie, I am a bit scared because a lot of things in there are really going to challenge social norms. And so I'm making myself vulnerable because now our society is heavily patriarchal. We're not really ready to be questioned. We're not really ready for women to do what they're best at. We're not really ready yet. There's a lot that's going on, and I feel like we have to talk about the hard stuff if we really want any change in South Sudan.
Gatbel says women should question why they are kept on the sidelines of politics, society, and the public space. She says women should not wait for men to give them permission to do what they know they can do. Gatbel says South Sudanese women must stand up for their daughters so that future generations of women are educated and can make informed decisions about their lives. And Gatbel leads by example. She is in her second year at Mount Royal University in Canada, where she is studying for a Bachelor of Arts degree. And then, of course, there are her poems that push the barrier of what's culturally acceptable in South Sudan. Poems like this one.
My God is not a he or a she. My God is not a gender but a spirit. My God is not Islam or Christianity. My God is beyond labels and limitations of man. My God cannot be contained in a book. My God is not trapped in the pages of man. My God is not carved idol hanging on the wall. My God is not the necklace you have on your neck. My God is not responsible for all the wrong in the world. My God is boundaryless and merciful. My God loves all the gays, bisexuals, and heterosexuals. My God is the spirit that lives within all of us. My God is the confidence that lives within us. My God is the natural love and goodness within all of us. My God is my God, and you can't put it in a box, and you can't put it a definition to it.
For VOA News, I'm Lucy Pony.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. On behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Werkinger, and our engineer, Pete Hundley, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Of the estimated 35.3 million people living with HIV/AIDS, some 3.2 million are children under the age of 15. Most of them, about 91%, live in sub-Saharan Africa. In 9 out of 10 cases, these children were infected during pregnancy, childbirth, or through breastfeeding. At birth, a baby's immune system is not fully developed. In a healthy child, it fully develops by about 6 months, but up to that point, the infant's immunity is boosted by antibodies transferred from the mother through breast milk. When mothers with HIV receive the proper medications, they can safely breastfeed their infants. However, when HIV-infected mothers do not receive anti-HIV medicines, their infants are at risk of becoming infected. Children with HIV infection often get sick. They have a difficult time fighting off common childhood maladies such as ear and sinus infections, pneumonias, urinary tract infections, intestinal illness, skin disease, and meningitis. In developing countries in particular, tuberculosis, diarrhea, and respiratory illnesses are common in HIV-positive children. If an HIV-positive child does not receive antiretroviral treatment, a cycle of illness may set in and further undermine the child's health. 80% of children infected with HIV at birth or in infancy die before their 5th birthday. It is therefore important to begin treating HIV-positive children with antiretroviral drugs as soon as possible. If taken every day, proper medication can drastically reduce the concentration of HIV in the bloodstream, thereby slowing the progression of the disease. But sadly, only 24% of HIV-infected children have access to antiretroviral drugs. That is why the United States, through the U.S. President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, or PEPFAR, in partnership with the Children's Investment Fund Foundation, launched the Accelerating Children's HIV/AIDS Treatment, or ACT, initiative. This two-year, $200 million program aims to double the number of children receiving antiretroviral treatment. Through this initiative, some 300,000 additional children living in Cameroon, Democratic Republic of Congo, Kenya, Lesotho, Malawi, Mozambique, Tanzania, Zambia, and Zimbabwe will get a better chance to grow to adulthood and lead full, healthy lives. Healthy children who can pursue their dreams are Africa's future. They will grow economies, create jobs, and contribute to their families and communities for decades to come.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Celebrate the sounds of Africa today, yesterday, and tomorrow. That's our mission in your show, Music Time in Africa. Hello, I'm your host, Heather Maxwell. Join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC and discover the best Pan-African music in the world. We play it all right here. Only the best on VOA Africa.